Welcome to Transition State. I am your host, as always, Adam Smiley, going out on the air, checking the mics. Check one, hear me now. And with me this week is a very special guest, Dr. Kenneth Wayne Riggs. Welcome, Wayne.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
How's that microphone?
I think it'll be fine. New experience for me.
Okay. For those who don't know, this is Transition State. This is the show by pharmacy students for, not pharmacy students, for everybody. And I am Adam Smiley. I'm the pharmacy student. And now I would like to start by giving our listeners a bit of an idea of who you are.
Thank you.
So let's start with the present tense and work our way backwards, retrospectively.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, so you are, I should have done my homework, but I think it's fun just to talk it out. So you are the Dean Academic at UBC Pharmaceutical Sciences.
Associate Dean Academic, yes.
So what is the difference between an associate dean and a real dean?
So we're the ones that do all the work for the dean.
Okay.
The dean is the, if you like, the manager, upper level manager, or boss, if you want to look at it in that way, for the faculty, and oversees the general operations and running of the whole faculty, and has that higher level function of management. Everyone reports to them ultimately, and they also function them with all the other deans, the president and the vice presidents and provosts of the university and so on. So that's their role. Whereas the associate dean, we have three associate deans. Myself is associate dean academic. We have an associate dean for research and graduate studies. So that's research focus and graduate students. And we have an associate dean practice innovation, which is a unique portfolio across Canada. And that individual, that's Dr. Peter Zed, is looking at how do we innovate in practice? What new things can we bring in? Mine is to oversee the academic programs and portfolios. So I have a number of directors that report to me, experiential education group, continuing professional development, educational support and development, student services. Those people I oversee and work with on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. And how long have you been the Associate Dean Academic?
For 2 years now.
For 2 years.
Yeah.
And before that, I think I remember the first time I saw you, you were the dean?
Yes, I was interim dean for about 7 months until Dean Coftrey arrived in August of 2013.
Okay, so right now you're the Associate Dean Academic. Before that,
right,
you're the...
which is the position I was to come into. And then our former dean, Bob Sindelar, resigned in January of 2013, and the provost asked me if I would step in and serve as interim dean until they recruited a new dean and had them in place.
Interim dean?
Yes. And so I still functioned as the dean.
Okay.
So that higher level, working with all the other deans across campus, the provost, the vice president, the president, it was a great experience. Short but sweet. We got a lot done in 7 months.
I'm really curious about the world of deans. I want to ask you more about, I really want to get through this retrospect.
Sure.
So before Dean Interim, you were?
I was a professor and acting associate dean acting associate dean only for about 3 months till I came into the interim dean role.
Okay.
Okay. And before that, I was a professor, so teaching, research program, doing those normal things, and some service in terms of chairing committees, running, being a member of various committees in the faculty. Can't remember them specifically at this point, but also sitting on or chairing a lot of graduate student committees as well.
So when did you become a professor at UBC Pharmacy?
So I started, you start initially as an assistant professor.
Okay.
So that was in 1989.
Nice, nice.
And boy, you're making me
push
back.
That's
a ways.
Okay.
And
that's...
then I transitioned, so if you make the grade and you have a your research program is solid, your teaching program is solid, your service, you can go up for promotion to associate, which I believe was 1996, and then to full professor, which is another step, 5 years later in 2001. And I stayed at that point until I became... I'm still a full professor.
Yes. Right on. Okay, I'll just give you a little idea.
Sure.
I did my first degree in economics. I graduated in 2003.
Yes.
And graduated high school in 1997, about the time where you were becoming a full prof.
Okay. Right.
So before you were an assistant professor at UBC,
mm-hmm.
what were you?
So I was doing my doctorate, my PhD, from 1985 to 1989. I graduated. Typically, there are 4 to 5 year time period to get your doctorate. Mine was a specialty in pharmacokinetics, drug metabolism. Prior to that, I worked for 2 years in hospital pharmacy practice in Kamloops in Royal Inland Hospital. And in the regular pharmacy department, making IV additives, doing general dispensing, and also having the opportunity to work in the intensive care unit, which was really challenging initially, but a great experience to work with physician specialists and highly trained nurses. It was a very rewarding experience for me.
And you did your PhD at UBC?
I did my PhD. All of my degrees have been done at UBC.
Okay. So before that hospital pharmacy, you were doing your...
master's degree.
At UBC.
At UBC. That was 79 till 82, part of 82.
Okay, that's when I was born.
You're just a baby, I tell you.
Okay, so before that, you did your undergrad?
I did my undergrad in 1971. So I graduated in 1971. I worked in community pharmacy practice for those 8 years, primarily in Kamloops for two great fellows who are awesome mentors, really taught me about patient interaction and importance of interacting with patients as clients and recognize them, and incredibly rewarding. I left Kamloops in 1977 and went to the Queen Charlotte Islands because there was a change in ownership for the pharmacies I was working at, and I worked there in the Queen Charlotte Islands Hospital. And that was a great experience, working with the Haida community, servicing the providing medications to the community, but also to hospital. It was an awesome time.
Huh. Okay.
Awesome time. But I truly enjoyed my time in community pharmacy practice. There's so much that you can do for patients. There's a real trust, bond of trust that you build with them. It's an incredibly rewarding time, and I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Still have a very big passion for that.
Oh, I really want to ask you more about that, too. Were you just working for, like, a Shoppers Drug Mart, or was it a...
It was an independent pharmacy.
Huh.
Kipps Pharmacy, it was called.
That name is actually familiar. Okay, so we're still going. So you did your undergrad. You finished in 1971?
71, long time ago. Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so before that, where did you go to high school?
In Turtleford, Saskatchewan.
Turtleford?
Yes.
No kidding?
Yes.
Okay.
So that was 6 years living in Turtleford. And before that, it was in more rural area around Baldwin and Cutknife, Saskatchewan. And my parents were farmers. I was born in BC, but actually grew up in Saskatchewan and was a farm kid.
When did you move to Turtleford?
In 1960.
Oh, okay.
So I would have just been 12, 13 years old then.
And before that, you were born in BC.
Yeah, in 1948.
No kidding.
I'm old guy. 67.
Yeah, you don't look it. Okay, then I'm curious, in that time, when did you meet your wife and get married and live happily ever after?
I met my wife in Kamloops in 1982 when I was working at Royal Inland Hospital. And I was also doing some part-time work for Kip Mallory. At that point, it was Kip Mallory, but one of the original owners was still there. And Sheila, my wife Sheila, was working for them in community practice, and that's how we met. And a couple years later, we got married in 1985. I'd come back to UBC at that point to start my doctorate.
Can I ask about how you guys met?
Just because we worked for the same people, the Kip Mallory. I worked part-time. They had two sites, and I worked in that site, and we would often just meet at lunch hour and just chat, and that's how it started.
You don't have to answer this, but I'm curious, did you sort of like her and then decide to get her? Or did she sort of choose you first and then she got you?
I think it was a bit of both.
Just came? Yes. Okay.
But knew it was right.
Right on. Okay, that's beautiful. I think, yeah.
Awesome lady. She's absolutely incredible supporter.
What does she do?
She's a pharmacist.
No kidding.
Yes.
Okay. I want to move on and ask you some pharmacy questions, but first sure. I want to say a disclaimer.
Sure.
That this is just meant to be a candid conversation between friends, and it's not medical advice, and I just really want you to not be on the hook for speaking on behalf of the faculty. We're not representing anybody's views here. We're just trying to be honest. So please don't take this as medical advice. Don't take this as anybody's official opinion. It's just friends talking.
Absolutely. You wouldn't want medical advice from me right now. I haven't practiced since 1985, so.
Okay. First question. Was it difficult to gain so much respect and adoration within the faculty, or did it come naturally to you?
I would say it came naturally.
Nice.
I think my view is I respect everyone for who they are, and I think we all have a place in society. We all contribute. And just because I happen to be a professor doesn't mean I'm better than you or anyone else. If we look at life as a continuum, I'm just at a certain spot on that continuum. You may be a bit behind me, but how can I bring you along? And how can I support you? And I treat everyone equally. I love working with people. Even though I'm actually, if you could see me as a child, very shy, introverted individual, in some ways I'm still that way. That's how I was brought up. That's how my parents brought me up. You know, that mutual respect for each other.
Good.
That's
parents.
How I live. Huh. And you get it back. Mm-hmm. And people will say to me, well, you know, the second year class is so disruptive and they're so unruly. And I'll say, well, I've never had that problem. In my whole 25 years, I've never had that. Well, why? It's how you interact. It's, you know, I respect you for where you are. I'm not better than you are. You're an expert on this radio station. I have no idea what you would do here.
Yeah.
Okay. I know a lot about pharmacokinetics. I'm going to help you learn some of that. Doesn't mean I'm better than you.
Okay.
That's how I operate.
Okay. I just want to briefly explain to our listeners who might not know what pharmacokinetics is. So let me try to explain it because I should know this. Pharmacokinetics, as opposed to pharmacodynamics, pharmacokinetics, or PK, deals with what the body sort of does to the drug after it's ingested. So take, for example, oral administration. You'll swallow it, it'll go down, it'll get absorbed through the mucosa into the bloodstream, and that's called absorption. So that can happen at different rates, speeds, and to a different extent. And then that drug will be distributed to various tissues and where it goes. So absorption, distribution, metabolism, so the body will usually, what's it called, bioreact?
Biotransform.
Right? Yep. It'll activate certain drugs or deactivate certain drugs. And then there's elimination. So the way the drug is eliminated through hepatic or if you pee it out, et cetera, stuff like that. So it's not looking at sort of what the drug does to the person. It's how the body handles the drug. Is that right?
Excellent, Adam. Okay. I got my message across.
So that's when I first met you, is you were teaching us all that stuff, and it's hard. And he made us do it the old way. We had to get out all the data, get out the rulers, and draw graphs and measure the distance. Oh, man. Okay.
And you need to know that. What if the lights go out? You have to be able to do it. There's no computer.
We're out of batteries. Okay. Then I want to ask you, what are the biggest changes you've seen in pharmacy practice in all those years?
So going back to my own training, so starting in 1967 and finishing in 71, there was a lot more emphasis on basic science in the program. So chemistry, dosage form design, that pharmaceutics, how do you design an emulsion, a suspension, all those kinds of things, making ointments, suppositories even making tablets. And so more chemistry focus, a lot of pharmacology, a lot of chemistry. So basic foundational things, even analytical chemistry, measuring drug levels, for example. And in 1971, that was the beginning of the era of what we call clinical pharmacy. And this had started in the U.S. a number of years before. And the faculty hired a fellow by the name of Dr. Jay Kalinka, who was a clinical pharmacist from the U.S. And my class was small. It was 28 students.
28?
28 students.
So right now it's 224. Wow.
Right. And we did all our learning in the old Cunningham building. There were two classrooms, one on the first floor and one on the third floor. And it's, again, small class. Everything was done there. And I was chosen as one of six students to be get introduced to clinical pharmacy.
Huh.
And that was very special. So we got to go to Vancouver General Hospital, go through charts, actually work some time with hospital pharmacists. So that was really quite unique and quite special. But even at that point, the focus largely was on your role as a dispenser. So you knew a lot about how medications were put together and pharmacology, what they were used for and dosage, but not so much the therapeutic aspects. Yes, you knew they were used for certain conditions and one was better than another. But when I first started practicing, drug names weren't even put on labels. You weren't allowed to put them on labels. And you didn't counsel people other than, you know, take this tablet 1-3 times a day or whatever those directions were. You were largely dispensing medications. I was a bit of a rogue because I would tell, I always called, not clients, but patients, what the drug was, what it did, why they were taking it.
Wow.
But it was about a year later, I think 72 or 3, when the bylaws were changed that you could put drug names on labels.
You couldn't put the drug name?
No. And at first it was only brand names that were on, not generic. And now you know it is generic typically before brand.
Wow.
So a very different time. And then the class 71, there was a larger jump in class size going up to, I think, 40. And then it went up to 50, 80 in the 70s. And around 82, I think it was around 90 students. And then we went to 120. During the 80s, and now, as you see, what is it, 4 years ago, we jumped from 152 to 224. So what are the biggest changes? The getting away from the focus on product to much more patient-centered care, pharmaceutical care, more clinical knowledge, more therapeutics, understanding disease states much better. So more emphasis there and a de-emphasis of the more foundational sciences or basic sciences. So we have far less chemistry in our program now than we used to, medicinal chemistry, far less pharmaceutics than we used to have. So those things are sort of dwindling. They'll do go down even more as we transition now to our new entry to practice PharmD program. There's less emphasis, far more emphasis on clinical skills, therapeutics.
Cognitive side.
Critical thinking,
understanding,
gathering information, assessing it, coming up with a care plan, identifying drug therapy problems. Not that we didn't learn that early on, but there's a lot more emphasis now.
Okay. I think it's normal to expect over time some ups and downs. Do you think right now in pharmacy things are getting better or worse?
I think there are a good number of challenges out there. I wouldn't say they're getting worse.
Sometimes I think that, like, I'm alone and I just hear something and you're like, what is happening to pharmacy here?
I feel the same way. Mm-hmm. So when I hear the issues around methadone clinics, for example, or pharmacists who are involved in methadone maintenance programs, and I think, oh my gosh, how unprofessional, how unethical is
right.
this? And my heart just sinks. But I think in every profession you will see examples of this. You know, if you look at medicine, then there are certain things that certain physicians do that are not terribly ethical either. Same in the nursing profession.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always there. But I think pharmacists, because they're the first individual often that the first healthcare provider rather that an individual come and consult. Are much more publicly in the eye,
mm-hmm.
and certainly in the media. And the media, of course, picks up on the things that are not so good rather than focusing on the things that are perhaps good. I think we're in a very challenging environment for community pharmacy practice in particular. Corporates are cutting the numbers of pharmacist hours, increasing the number of pharmacy assistants or technicians. And pharmacists are under a lot of pressure to continue their normal sorts of workload, manage those technicians, make sure that this is truly the right drug for that patient, assess, make those assessments, do all those drug therapy problem identification things, counsel patients, all of that, and yet have less other pharmacist support present at the time. So how are they supposed to really be exercising full scope of knowledge and skills when they don't have time to do so? So our scope of practice has gone up. You're allowed to do adapting prescriptions, medication reviews, give vaccinations or immunizations. How am I going to do all of that when I'm expected to do those basic functions?
Your employer is asking you to double your numbers.
Right, yeah. So there's a lot of stress there. So I think that is a dipping point for us right now. Mm-hmm. I think pharmacists tend to be too passive. We need to be a stronger voice and more proud of who we are, and really rise up to these to the corporates. Often the leads are not pharmacists, and you know they're business people. Mm. But this is who we are as a profession. That's how we want to be seen by the public. We want to be able to do our jobs fully. You need to support us to do that.
It's a vital time. It's almost like pharmacy is really coming of age right now.
It is. And there's so much we have to offer. And we, if I think of the students that graduate from our Bachelor of Science program currently, the knowledge base, the skill set that you have is far superior to what it was even 5-10 years ago.
Really?
And certainly very superior to what I had in 1971.
And
pharmacists who've been in practice for a number of years will tell you that. The quality of the graduate students in terms of knowledge is way up here. Hmm. Yes, their maturity around practice, day-to-day practice is not there, but it shouldn't be expected to be there because you're coming out at that entry level.
Okay.
So we are in a crisis, I agree. But it's turning it over to individuals like yourself who are that new generation of graduates who have more different level of understanding, training, critical assessment skills, all of that, and transforming. So, you know, leaders have changed. We keep saying that. And students are, every class that graduates is a leader of change. You need to get into those corporate roles,
right?
Management roles, and change things.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned leadership and strong voices. Speaking of strong voices, when did you first meet Mary Ensom?
Mary would have come in the early 1990s. And so coming from the University of Kentucky in the U.S., very skilled clinical pharmacist. Clinical pharmacokinetics is her area. So where my training is more basic science kinetics. Mm-hmm. So those absorption, distribution, metabolism things that you talked about at a more basic level, and that was my research program as well. Hers is more applied, so applying it to the patient setting. So yeah, awesome colleague.
Did she have like a reputation before she came, or was she sort of
yes.
an unknown? And yeah.
Yes, she did. Already well-established as a clinician and worked very, very much in clinical practice before she came here. Yes, so she definitely, and she still has a stellar reputation which grows every day.
I think, yeah, well-earned, well-earned. Yeah. Okay, so then is there hope for the future of pharmacy?
I think so. I think we need to let go of the past, and there's many pharmacists who are still in current practice who are still comfortable with that traditional role, largely dispensing role, and yes, counseling and so on, but we need to let go of that and really recognize that we do have the training, we do have the knowledge, and we'll develop a lot more practice confidence as we get into practice and have a chance to work in an environment to really show the public who we are and to show other healthcare providers that we are incredibly knowledgeable. We are medication experts, and that's our knowledge. We're not diagnosticians. That's the physician's role. But we do train you now for basic monitoring skills, vital signs, recognition mm-hmm. of certain disease states, and so on, how to monitor for those things. You have a lot to give.
Yeah.
But communicate more to the public. We tend to be, as I said, quite reserved as a profession. if you look at us compared to nursing says, sorry, docs, step aside. We're taking that over. We don't do that. You need to be obviously respectful, and you want to be collaborative about it.
Right.
But you do have a skill set, a knowledge set that nurses don't have, that physicians don't have about drugs. How can we use that? How can we collaboratively work together for that betterment of that patient? That's what it should have been. Is there hope? Yes, there's hope. Go out there and shine. just take it on. Challenge yourself. So certify as an asthma specialist, diabetes specialist. Whatever it is, take it on. Go to rural communities where often you're the only individual there or one of two where you can make a real impact compared to the city. I worked in several rural communities, actually. It's incredibly rewarding. I was effectively prescribing in the 1970s because I had a family physician who was in this same shopping center as the pharmacy that I worked at, and he would phone and come over and see me, Wayne, this is what the patient has, what would you recommend? Okay, and he'd go back and write the prescription. Huh. Or he would write it there. So you do have that skill set. I got to use that a lot more when I was in the Queen Charlotte's. Great relationship with the docs there. They phone you at 3 o'clock in the morning. You have a patient with a GI bleed. You need to be giving him an infusion of cimetidine. This is what you do.
And he needs to ask the pharmacokinetics. Okay.
So there's lots you can do. Challenge yourself. Always be respectful of other healthcare providers and work in collaboration.
Okay, good advice. Okay, I have one more question. It might be hard to answer, but all the things that you've accomplished seem to be, the flip side of everything that I hope to accomplish in the future. So I'm curious, when you get to the end, is there a feeling there? Do you get I'm imagining this amazing good feeling when I do finally get everything done, and I'll look back and say, there. Am I fooling myself or?
No, I think you're right. I think whatever we do, at some point you're very proud of what you've accomplished and what you've done. And for me, it's having that privilege really to work with students, to work with colleagues in a practice environment, in an academic environment. But to come to university has really been a privilege to be able to be part of student learning and helping them learn certain sets of information and the rewards that come with that, to be able to mentor them and again work with key colleagues and advance our curriculum and to be able to conduct research and train graduate students and see how they go and they develop and how successful they become and how you will become successful as a practitioner or using pharmacy as a base to grow. So yeah, I'm very pleased, very proud of what I've accomplished. I would never have seen this in myself as that introverted, shy kid in grade one who didn't want to be on the stage performing, trembling. That I would never imagine going from that point to actually being able to sit in the dean's chair. Never. Huh. So yes, I'm very proud and of being given that privilege and opportunity.
When you're the dean, you got that nice big necklace. You feel like a big, big kahuna.
I suppose so.
Okay, well, we got lots more coming up with Dr. Riggs, but first we're going to hear a couple public service announcements. So here we go. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
sensational new show is coming to town. The Dusty Flower Pot Cabaret invite you all to attend the 1955 musical extravaganza, The Scarlet Queen of Mercy. This extraordinary theatrical event came from one spark of inspiration. What if our audience was cast as the extras in a B-movie musical? What's more, if you come dressed to the nines in the style of the times, you could be moved to the VIP section or pulled into the action on stage. This is a fully immersive, totally original, and completely unforgettable event. The Scarlet Queen of Mercy will be at the iconic Russian Hall at 600 Campbell Street in Strathcona. Shows run from May 14th to 17th, 21st to 24th, and a holdover possibility for May 28th to 31st. All shows are at 8 p.m.
And we're back. You're listening to Transition State. This is the show dedicated to raising pharmaceutical awareness in the community. I'm your host, pharmacy student Adam, and with me is basically the guy who was nerdy before nerdy was cool, Dr. Wayne Riggs. Welcome, Wayne.
Thanks again.
Okay, so we did some good pharmacy talk. Now I'd like to ask you about some other of your favorite pursuits. So first of all, the truth is, this is a fact. It was a rumor for a long time, but you are retiring.
I am retiring on July 15th, 2015.
For real?
For real.
Okay, so what are you going to do?
I'm really looking forward to, first, to having time to rest and come down to ground state.
Okay.
Been very busy, especially the last couple of years in the administrative roles. I love to garden. Okay. I can't wait to be outside and not have to worry about generating a report for the next day or preparing for this class or driving to work from Delta. Just having time to do gardening, as I say, I love that. I grow orchids as a hobby. Being able to get on my bike. I bought a new bike 2 years ago. I think I've ridden it 20 minutes. So, and I have friends who recently retired that are bikers. They play golf. Not bikers in the sense of motorcycles, but cyclists. Yep. And hiking, fishing, camping, all that stuff that I love to do. And I haven't been able to do quite so much in recent years. So lots of those things. Small rentals around the house.
Just basically be retired.
Just be retired. Travel a bit. With Sheila and I plan to have some travel plans. Not huge ones, but perhaps going on a cruise in September with friends.
Hey, hey.
Yeah.
Is she retired?
No. Sheila is going to continue to work probably full-time for the next 3 years. They often say it's not good for couples to retire at the same time.
Okay. Give you a little bit of a head start. Okay.
One gets used to the idea, settles in, and then the other one comes along.
Yeah, one of
She warns me that she has a job list very long, and that I will be cooking all the meals and doing all the house cleaning. So, but I can assure you we'll negotiate that.
Okay. This is random, but I want to do a little bit of... This next question involves a little bit of role play. Okay? So I'm going to be Sheila, and you just be you.
Okay, but we'll see how this goes.
It's the 80s, okay? Okay? So it's role play. Here we go. Wayne, can you tell me why there's pee in the fridge?
Yes, dear. She wouldn't be quite so polite about it.
So what would your answer to that
be? My answer would be that I am a graduate student, and as part of that, I am part of a drug study. So I'm collecting pee or urine to do drug analysis and kinetic studies, and also giving blood samples when I'm at the lab. So that's why it's there. And yes, I understand why you don't want it there.
But it has to be in your home fridge?
It does. Because we have to collect all of it. We can't lose some of it. That's why.
Okay, that's the price of science.
It is.
Okay.
And we've been there, Adam.
Yeah?
For real.
Oh, dear. I have not. I can only imagine. So what were you working on? What can you say, like, which drug it was?
We worked on a number of drugs. One was metoclopramide, which is used as a prokinetic energy, so to empty the stomach before surgery.
Get those guts moving.
So we were, that was one of my initial studies in patients. So women who were having elective cesarean section for delivery of the child, and the metoclopramide would be given to them in advance, usually an hour before, just to make sure the stomach was emptied in case they needed a general anesthetic. Because when you put people under general anesthesia, their risk of aspiration of stomach contents into the lungs when you do that intubation step. So that's why, to empty it out. So we collected samples of the mother's blood. We also got cord blood from the babies at the time they were surgically removed or delivered. And we would look at the levels of drug in the mom and in the baby and do what we call, it's a single point measurement, a fetal to maternal ratio. And that gives you some index of drug exposure. So that's one of the...
Okay.
Yes.
Is metoclopramide mostly excreted in the urine?
It is quite extensively metabolized and excreted in the urine. So we'd measure urine levels, we could only do that for the mum, of course. We did a lot of studies in model systems, too, where you can collect a lot more extensive sampling. I think one of the later things that I was involved in with patients was pregnant women who were being treated for pre- and postpartum depression. So working with a special group that... of psychiatrists that works with women who are experiencing these depressions during pregnancy or following delivery. And there they're taking the serotonin reuptake inhibitors largely, so measuring those levels during pregnancy, at birth, in the mom, in the baby, following the babies for 2-3 days after birth, couple months, a month after birth, 2 months after birth, looking at drug levels again. Very rewarding, so making contributions to the literature there in terms of drug exposure to that developing fetus, to the child at birth and baby at birth and so on. So yeah, it was
pretty good
very
work.
Exciting.
Then I'm really curious about, if you have the urine sample, how do you figure out how much drug is in there in the 80s? You get out the microscopes?
No.
Or was there a
so
mass
we had mass spectrometers were just becoming available for routines, not routine even then, but drug analysis. But before that, you had ultraviolet detectors, fluorescence detectors. You could do it that way. Or then came along the separation kind of equipment. So chromatography, initially it was paper chromatography, but then we went into columns.
Right.
So you could separate compounds based on differences in chemical structure, polarity, charge, that kind of things to get separation, and then run them through a detection system like an ultraviolet detector or a fluorescence detector. Later came mass spectrometers. So when I came along, when I started my master's, we had access to gas chromatography. Mass spectrometry came along in that time as well, and certainly much more applied in my doctoral program, my PhD.
Do you ever miss it?
I loved working in the lab. I love taking things apart. So how does that equipment work? And it breaks down. I can probably fix it myself. I love to do things like that, yes. So I did miss that. As soon as I got into my assistant professor role, I started spending less and less time in the lab and directing students, so taking on your grad students, technicians who do the work largely for you. Yes.
Last week I did a tour of the Klassen lab, Dr. Klassen.
Yes.
And wow, lots of fancy equipment. She has
for
stuff
sure.
That's on a bed of nitrogen. It's got to be so still.
Correct.
Oh, very cool. And one thing that I noted was she has these very fancy pipettes. She's a pipette girl. But I always, you know, in intro organic chemist stuff, labs, we always had the old pipetting with the like a bulb
that's
and the
right.
air. And there was a skill to it.
There was.
Did you use the old pipettes back then?
Absolutely. And before there were bulbs even, you used to use your lips and
no
suck
kidding.
Up. And now, of course, you'd never get away with that because of the toxicities related to chemicals and so on. But seriously, we used to do that, even as a grad student. And then the bulbs became readily available or commonly used, or little pumps that you pushed a dial on and they would suck up.
Yeah, just dial in your number and press the
those
button.
Those things are awesome now. So you have single channel or multiple, you can do 10, 12 samples at once.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But the skill is being lost. Because that was the one thing I was good at. And now, unfortunately, it's not
automation. It's all becoming automated to a large degree, or semi-automated.
True. Okay, next question. You mentioned orchids.
Yes.
Do you know where that word comes from?
You know, I should. I don't remember. It's Yes, orcus. It's a Latin word, Greek Latin roots.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a sexual connotation.
Has to do with male part of the anatomy.
Right.
You're correct.
I guess I want to ask, why are orchids so sexy?
I wonder. It's the largest plant family in the world in terms of numbers of species and diversity. And they grow everywhere from Siberia to tropical countries and even in desert areas or mm-hmm. semi-desert areas. Why are they so sexy? I think the beauty of them, the way they are very sophisticated in terms of attracting, pollinating insects or moths, ants, and the lengths that they go to attract a certain type of pollinator. The lips that flip out and trap them inside so they can't get out, or there's just a little portal they have to squeeze through. Yes, it's an amazing plant group.
And they evolve like really specific relationships to sort of.
They do.
Like one type of orchid will go for one kind of.
Yes. Huh. And they need a certain type of fungus, mycorrhiza, to grow well. So it gets on the roots, symbiotic relationship.
I lived in Thailand for a while, and you see orchids growing, and sometimes they seem positively shameless. Am I wrong?
No, you're right.
Okay. So is that part of your secret for staying sexy, is orchids?
No.
Orchid, for the record, orchid is Latin for testicles.
That's right.
I think it's
I didn't
roots.
Want to say it. Yes.
You're the silent sexy, Dr. Riggs. Okay, I think I cracked the code there. All right. When did you first get into orchids?
I think in about 1973 or 4, again working as a community pharmacist in Kamloops, and during my lunch hour, there was a new little shop that had opened that was, it had a whole gamish of things in it. It was one of general sort of household things, and they had this beautiful, I walked through it, and they had this beautiful Cattleya orchid. It was amazing. It was just covered with about 15 flowers. That's the old traditional corsage orchid.
What was it called? Cattleya?
Cattleya.
Cattleya.
So I thought, wow, that's pretty amazing. And I just left it there. But the next day, I went back and bought it. And that was the start. It was the start of an addiction. I now have between 260, 270 orchid plants.
But they're quite finicky, are they not? They're
some are incredibly finicky. So you need to really, to grow some well, you have to understand where they come from, what their cultural environment is, what are the differences in day temperature, humidity. Some grow in tropical rainforests. How am I going to duplicate that in my environment? Some are very cool growing. Some are very warm growing. Some are in the middle. So yes, it is. If you really get into it and you become very sophisticated, there's a lot of knowledge you need to acquire to be successful. I've killed lots. I have a pot where I put all the tags of the deceased orchids.
Oh, dear.
It's quite full. So there are things that I've learned that don't go there, don't grow those ones, even though they're amazingly beautiful. That's not for you. They don't fit with the environment that you have.
It seems like you almost think of them in terms of personality. Like, oh, that one doesn't like that. Oh, no, they won't. No, don't go there.
True. And you move them around in your growing space. So you find that this one needs a lot more light, so I'm going to put it way up high in the greenhouse. And when you do that, often within a few months, it'll reward you by flowering, which it's never done before. You may have had it for 6-7 years, and it's never. But you haven't put it where it needs to be or even treated it properly. It needs more humidity or cooler temperatures, all that kind of stuff.
Do you ever talk to them?
I don't think I talk to them, but I tell you, it's almost like waiting for the birth of a child when you get a new one and it flowers
really?
For the first time. It sounds ridiculous. Probably sounds ridiculous. But it's true, and you wait for that flower to come out. Sometimes you're disappointed because genetically it doesn't turn out the way it was supposed to. And then it can be amazingly gorgeous. Yes. Yeah, it's an addiction.
A healthy addiction. Though.
Healthy one.
Okay.
Although Sheila is threatened to take away my credit cards and wallet when I retire.
Well,
because I won't have an income like I have now.
hopefully the ones you have can keep you happy for a
they
while.
They will.
Okay. We still have lots more to talk about. I have some listener questions, and I want to ask you about your favorite music. but we're going to hear a couple more station IDs first. So stay tuned out there and keep listening.
What is this?
CITR 101.9 FM.
A center for ants!
What?
We're a radio station broadcasting from UBC Vancouver.
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
Visit CITR.ca.
Derek, it's just a...
I don't want to hear your excuses! The center has to be at least... 3 times bigger than this!
There are 2 things I will carry in my pockets at the end.
Yeah, you guys were always the cool radio station with the, like, fun magazine and everything.
That's right, Discorder.
The delicious we had, yeah. We always wanted a magazine like that back in the day. Man,
yeah.
My campus radio roots go deep.
We just actually reformatted the Discorder, so it's now in this new cool zine size, and we're really excited about it.
Yeah, that was always the cool thing when it came into the station. We're always like, oh man, this is so cool. How do we get this going? And it's really cool that it's all, like, even sponsored and everything.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's really fun. This is Sasha Bilot, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Class, settle down. My name is Chris Connolly from the band Hot Panda, also known as your professor. Let's get one thing straight. If there's some of you that think this class is going to be a walk of the cake or a flop about in the park, you are sadly mistaken. Half of you will drop out. And the other half of you will wish that you were dead. If I could offer any advice to those of you still hell-bent on attempting to pass my class, it would simply be to keep your radio tuned to CITR 101.9 when you're in Vancouver.
Has mental illness or addiction touched your life? You might be interested in coming out to the Kaleidoscope, UBC's first and only student-created, peer-run mental health support group at the University's Vancouver campus. They offer a stigma-free place for people to share their stories with others going through similar experiences. The Kaleidoscope meets every week on Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. at the Center for Student Involvement in Brock Hall.
Learn more at the-kaleidoscope.com.
And we are back. This is Transition State, increasing pharmaceutical know-how in the community with Dr. Wayne Riggs.
Thanks again, Adam. It's actually turned out to be an enjoyable experience.
It's fun, right? Okay.
Yes.
So I have some questions here from loyal listeners. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. If you could be any drug, what drug would you be?
If I could be any drug, what would I be?
And why?
I suppose one of the... mood enhancers.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, not that I'm a depressed person, but I think they perhaps give you a very cheerful outlook on life.
Okay. What do you think is the sexiest drug?
Sexiest drug? That's a tough one. I'm not sure.
I think
sure
it's going back to the orchids. You have this sub rosa sexiness going on.
Apparently now they're beginning to find some chemical compounds in orchids that may have drug-like properties.
Mm.
I've read a little bit about that recently, but that's really early stuff. There's really, orchids have never been used medicinally. They haven't been. The sexiest drug. Viagra, I suppose,
Viagra
from a male's perspective.
Going, yeah. The Gliptins have sexy names.
They do. Yes, Cita and all these new antibody
right,
type
yeah.
compounds.
Right, from Roxaban.
You can pronounce them, I can't. Yes, there's so many of these new peptide therapeutics.
Okay. What will you miss the least about your job at UBC?
The commute to and from North Delta.
No fun?
You know, it's just become a lot more stressful with the years, the increase in traffic and, you know, Vancouver winter rains and Wow. Sometimes it'll take you a long time to get home. It's very stressful. I won't miss that at all.
It's like the worst part of your day.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, I lived in Japan for a while, and man, there's some commuting. You know, an hour is about the threshold. If it's over an hour, man, this is a lot of time. Because you double it, because it's twice a day.
Yes.
And out of your, say, 14 waking hours, you're spending two or more on just this commute?
Yeah, my tolerance limit is about an hour as well. And then I really start to get a bit agitated. Although I tend to be, I think, a respectful driver. If I give the finger sign, it's in my head usually.
What do you drive? Let me guess. Lexus? Maybe.
No.
Is it fancy?
No, it's not fancy. It's a common car.
Honda
Volkswagen.
Civic. Oh, okay.
Volkswagen, which
quality
is
quality marksmanship? I mean,
a Golf.
Craftsmanship?
The Golf.
Hey,
yeah.
The TDI?
Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Okay, that's a good ride. Okay.
I love driving it. It's a great car to drive.
All right, and who is the smartest person you've ever met? To you, the smartest person you've ever met.
Wow. I'm drawing a memory blank here.
That's a tough one.
Michael Smith, who is our Nobel laureate for UBC.
Right, Michael Smith Labs.
You know, I remember him as an undergraduate student when I took physiology, and being and meeting him as a professor. And then when I joined UBC and when I was a graduate student, we used to go to the Graduate Student Center on Fridays to have a beer or two. And he and others would all commonly be there. And often our professors would go too. It was quite a social sort of event. And he was so calm, and you could just walk up to him on the sidewalk and talk to him.
Really?
And I often had that opportunity over the years going into my role as a professor and so on. The guy was amazingly bright and yet so calm and so
down
personable.
To earth. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know what you mean.
Yeah,
I know
just
what you mean.
Amazing person. Others within the faculty, certainly Dr. Ensom, John McNeil.
Sharp cookies, huh?
Yeah. Frank Abbott. Wow. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about Michael Smith. As I've passed by his lab many times, and I'm aware he won the Nobel Prize. Do you know what work he was doing that won him that?
It's really going back to PCR, so
polymerase chain reaction,
and initiating that.
So DNA.
So being able to replicate DNA, that was really the beginnings of that whole era that would change virtually everything that we do now.
That's so simple now, the PCR.
Yeah.
You could do that.
Yeah. Incredible.
Anyway. Huh. Very cool. And is he still around? Is he still at UBC?
No, he passed away a number of years ago.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was his lab still going strong?
His lab is still there. Still called the Michael Smith Labs, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing you got to hang out with him.
Yeah, you know, it was limited exposure, but amazing fellow.
Cool.
And Walter Gage was another, who was the dean, one of the early presidents at UBC, again, when I was an undergrad. It was a mathematician.
You met Walter Gage?
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Common as the grass. Just amazing teacher. Calculus. Wow.
That's hard stuff to make accessible.
Not with him. And his classroom, you wouldn't be registered in that section. The stairwells were filled in the Hebb Theater. People were lining up at the doors just to listen. It was just like writing on a page and it becoming black on white, intimately clear. Just wow.
And later he became the president?
He was president at that
time.
Point.
And he's still accessible?
Yeah.
Huh, because I feel like the chances of me meeting the president of UBC are like...
Now they're pretty remote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Wow, very interesting. I think we're the same in that we tend to gravitate towards the down-to-earth people.
Yeah.
That pulls a lot of weight for me,
yes.
too. Okay, we only have a few minutes left, and I really want to ask you about music. So what kind of music... Do you like music? Do you listen to music?
I do. I'll listen to music a lot on the drive-in. At home, yes, too. But so what do I listen to? Well, right now my youngest son is in second year engineering and he is commuting back and forth with me, so it's more often his choice than mine. But what do we listen to? On Sirius, BPM, dance, electronic. I really like it. It's
really?
Fabulous. A lot of it. It's just really upbeat and exciting. We also listened to Kiss FM.
Okay.
So the Kid Carson show. Yeah, Kid Carson, Randy.
That's
Andrews.
A bit of our antithesis here.
Yeah. But that it's also that chatter. I love to, if I'm alone, I like to listen to CBC a lot.
Oh, okay.
The talk shows.
Yeah, oh, I'm all over CBC.
All this stuff. I really enjoy that. Classical, I like classical music too. Just pop, general pop music I like. I'm not terribly fond of really heavy jazz. Light jazz, yes, but virtually everything I enjoy.
Do you ever, you said you like classical music? Do you ever go to see the UBC Orchestra?
I have. And this past year, Sheila and I rejoined after many, many years the Vancouver Symphony series. And so we went to some of those. It was very enjoyable.
Yeah, I love going to the Chan Center. It's so classy.
Oh, it's a great, great theater.
They're all dressed up and they have these nice instruments.
Yes.
Just beautiful.
Yeah,
they're warming up.
And the acoustics there are very, very good.
Oh, you really like feel the sound almost. Okay. Do you have a favorite song of all time?
I probably have lots, but let's pick a couple just for today.
Okay.
So one would be Uptown Funk, and why would I choose that? I had my last class with the second year students on March the 10th, and they did a flash mob based on Uptown Funk, and that will always, always be with me. I'm getting a bit emotional.
I was there. That was great. That was a great moment.
I know. So second, third, and fourth year students doing that. It was amazing, amazing tribute to my teaching career. Another one that is really catchy lately that I like is Sean Hook and It's Sound of Your Heart Beating. It's just, it's so bouncy, and I think of my wife when I hear that because she's so special to me.
Nice. Sean Hook, I honestly haven't heard that. That's you teaching me.
Yeah, really a nice tune. Really a good beat to it.
Awesome. Did you ever listen to punk music?
Not a lot. No.
Not punk.
No.
What about when you were growing up, like in Saskatchewan? What do you listen
to? Know, not so much. There was a lot of the Beach Boys, Neil Diamond.
Just pop stuff?
Just common, just that popular everyday thing. The Beatles, of course, came along.
Rolling Stones?
Yes. Some Rolling Stones. I'm not really into heavy metal.
Oh, okay.
Really that hard, heavy rock stuff. That's not me.
More like the melodic,
yep.
Nice stuff.
Yep.
Okay. I guess that's about it. Did I miss anything?
I don't think so. I think you've been very thorough.
I think we covered everything.
I enjoyed it, Adam.
Okay, well.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, oh, thank you for coming and supporting student radio. I'm sure there'll be some happy listeners out there for your efforts.
I hope so. Pleasure.
And I look forward to hopefully seeing you again.
You will.
You'll be happily retired, and I'll be working my butt off.
But you can find me. Email.
Okay. Okay, well, then that's it for this week. So another bit of housekeeping I should mention is that this is the last episode of Transition State for the summer. I have a lot of work to do, and so I'm going to go on rotation and leave you hanging. But I will be back in September. We're going to have some good guests lined up. And I also wanted to mention that Dr. Riggs was quite hesitant to come on air today. So everybody be extra grateful. I finally got him on by asking him on my birthday. I asked him. I didn't want anything for my birthday except for Dr. Riggs on the show. So that's how I got him.
And I decided, okay, I'll give you a birthday present and I will come. And it actually turned out not bad at all. And I think I said earlier, we need to challenge ourselves with something new. And I look forward to new challenges now as I enter this new stage of my life.
Okay.
So thanks again.
Okay, thank you. And we'll see you. Have a good summer, radio fans. Stay tuned because Dunkin' Donuts is up next. There's always some good hits. And until September, stay pharmaceutically sound and just stay cool. Bye.
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge. Because you're mine, I walk the line. We'll be right back.
Wake up, dear circumstance. We really must get out tonight. I feel I